Hello and welcome to Talking Law, the podcast where you can hear barristers, judges, solicitors, managing partners and more talk about their careers and lives in law. I'm Sally Penny, MBE. I'm a barrister at Kenworthy's Chambers in Manchester and I'm the founder of Women in the Law UK. Today I'm delighted to be interviewing Susanna McGibbon. Susanna is His Majesty's Procurator General. She's also the Treasury Solicitor and the Permanent Secretary of the Government Legal Department, or GLD. Susanna advises on some of the most sensitive and significant issues affecting government and the civil service. As the head of the GLD, she's in charge of 3,000 people who are based around the country. As Susanna explains, she's what she describes as being the lawyer of last resort.
My role is to be the most senior civil servant who is engaged in giving legal advice to the government of the day.
Right.
And I've been a civil servant since 1993, so I'm one of the lifers within the civil service.
That was reading my face in response to the years.
Yes. And as part of my career and the careers of the people that work in the government legal department, we have a range of disciplines. We have, many people will be familiar with the litigation group that we have, yes, defending the government in court,
yes,
defending particularly judicial reviews.
Yes.
But we, in fact, represent the government in a wide range of litigation matters, both private law and public law, because, like any organisation, the government and the civil service has all sorts of private law matters, whether it's employment issues or,
yes,
commercial matters. We're a big buyer of stuff.
Yes.
So lots of legal advice required around that. We also have teams that are co-located with government departments, providing a general counsel type advisory role for each government department. And they're the people who are advising on new policies,
yes,
who advise on legislation and instruct parliamentary counsel, our specialist drafters, to draft the legislation that's put before Parliament.
Wow.
We also have, within our teams, and when I was an advisory lawyer, I also was involved in drafting secondary legislation. So any regulations, orders, and statutory instruments are drafted by the GLD lawyers mostly.
Wow. I mean, that is a huge, huge department, mm, and your role, mm, is huge. And I'll come later on to some of the, perhaps, the case that's meant something to you, a particular one I've got a question about. But how did you end up in that role? Because you're from Bolton. Now, let me finish.
That's lots of great people come from Bolton.
Yes, let me list some of them who have been on this podcast. Maxine Peake, the actress from Silk.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Kew, who was an advisor to a police department. He's now a lecturer. Peter Kay from Bolton.
Have you had him on the podcast?
No, not yet. Not yet. And, of course, now you. A great deal of talent has come out of Bolton, and I have a soft spot for Bolton because I used to go there to do a lot of cases at Bolton, mm, Crown Court. Mm. So I just wondered how, you know, a northern lass, if I may say so, has ended up in such a huge role with great expertise. Mm. How did that come about?
Well, it's an interesting question because I don't quite know how I got into law in the first place because there were no lawyers in my family. But I'm going to show my age again now, but you remember that programme Crown Court?
Yes.
That was on the telly?
Yeah.
I remember particularly liking the outfits that the barristers were wearing, and I thought I quite fancy being a barrister and knew nothing about the study of law. But fortunately, and quite unusually, the school where I did my A-levels offered law as an O-level. So I just thought, well, I'll have a dabble. I'll do another O level,
yes,
and see if I find it interesting.
Wow!
And that's
and
what
then
I
came
did.
From there.
And I was the only person in the school doing law O level, taught by someone who I think his only qualification was as a magistrate. but it was fine, and it confirmed to me that I was not going to be the research chemist that I originally had my heart set on, but actually was interested in developing arguments,
yes,
public speaking, language and history. And it sort of put all that in a bowl, and yeah, I think law comes out.
Yes. Amazing. Well, tell me, when you came to London then, or when you began your career in the civil service, what was it like? Were there many women? I mean...
So, the civil service is a separate matter entirely. When I first came to London and did pupillage in chambers,
yes,
there were some women around, but I have to say, it was quite a culture shock suddenly to be surrounded by so many privately educated and Oxbridge graduates.
Yes.
But it was lovely as well. So, yeah, yeah. But it was unusual to be state educated and non-Oxbridge in,
yes,
those days.
Yes, I suspect so.
So I think I always thought I would come to London. Mm. I think London was the home of law. And at the time, of course, you could only do bar exams in London.
Yes.
Whereas now you can
everywhere.
You can do
literally
them all over the place, can't you?
So, yes.
So, and funnily enough, I was born in London. So there's a sort of symmetry in it in the end.
Yes, but always meant to come back somehow.
Well, interestingly, I mean, you will joke at this. I do like my coincidences, but I was born in Westminster Hospital.
What?
So not only did I come back to London and do law, I ended up in the civil service where I live and breathe Westminster.
Yeah, well, because I've been to your office, you can actually see Buckingham Palace.
That's
from
right.
Yes. Your office and all things in the location.
Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting that you've come to London, because, of course, the Government Legal Department has offices in Leeds, Manchester, Bristol, I think.
Absolutely, yeah, and I'm really thrilled about that. Yes. This is quite a recent development.
Yes, I was going to say, it wasn't always, of course.
No, not so.
How's that and why has that come about?
Well, partly because I'm committed to GLD,
yes,
in line with broader civil service policy, reflecting the country that we serve.
Yes.
And that means nationally, that means tapping into talent,
yes,
across the country.
Yes.
So there's a business dimension to it as well. And I think it's important that the government of the day is advised by people who reflect the society we serve.
Hear, hear. And if ever there was levelling up, that is levelling up, if I may say so, which I've been banging on about talent and a wide sort of pool of talent all round. Suzanne, I want to ask you about what's it like? Like, what's your typical day working in the Government Legal Department and being head of it? I rather assumed, before I did some research, you had to be a solicitor by virtue of the title.
No, exactly.
It doesn't mean that at all, does
no,
it?
Neither am I a solicitor, nor do I only work for the Treasury. I work for every government department.
I see.
Yes. So it's the Treasury solicitor is an ancient role, goes back into the 12th century or something.
Wow.
When the Treasury was the main civil service department supporting the Prime Minister. And if you remember, the Prime Minister's actually called the First Lord of the Treasury.
Yes, I've read that. I didn't really understand
it. So that's where the two come together.
I see.
Yeah. So what's a typical day? My typical day will be very different to the typical day of the junior lawyers in,
yes,
the department. So as I was in my career developing my skills as a lawyer, then my typical day would involve, as I've mentioned, drafting legislation,
yes,
talking to policy colleagues, fellow civil servants who are developing new policies. In the past, I was responsible for advising the people who were creating policy around teachers and the teachers' terms and conditions and,
wow,
teachers' pensions. And then I would draft the regulations that would bring into force the amendments to the teacher's pension scheme, things like that.
Things like that.
Nowadays, I'm much more likely to spend my time in meetings rather than drafting learned legal opinions.
Yes.
Very much advising personally on some of the most sensitive and significant issues affecting government and the civil service. So,
yes,
the cabinet secretary may call me for urgent advice. But most of the time, the advice comes from my teams, and I'm very much, you know, the almost the lawyer of last resort. Because the teams are terrific, and they have excellent relationships with their client departments, and, you know, prepare the legislation, provide the advice to ministers, and generally provide what government needs to implement its policies.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this is a good time to ask you, if I may, about a case that I suppose might, I want my say, means a lot to you. And what I mean by that is just that I don't give many interviews, but when I do outreach work, universities and schools, you know, they like to ask you. And I often go back to kind of, you know, there's lots of big cases, aren't they? Good results, whatever, you know, some of the Court of Appeal, some not, whatever. And I go back to sort of some of the first cases that I did because that's when you're at the height of it. But in your case, it's very different, I would have thought. And there is a case, I think, because you were in Miller 1.
That's right, yes.
So just tell us a bit about that.
So you might expect me to identify a case where it was a, you know, a glorious victory.
Yes.
for the government. But, of course, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. But it was a fascinatingly significant case to be involved in.
Yes.
As it was developed. We were breaking new ground. All the parties to the litigation were breaking new ground.
Yes.
In the post-Brexit environment, and understanding just where the constitutional balance lay between the executive, parliament and the courts.
Yes.
was super interesting.
Yeah.
And very important. So I was privileged enough. I was head of litigation at the time, the director of our litigation group. And so I was involved as we prepared the case in the run-up for the High Court and then ultimately, of course, the Supreme Court. Mm. And I was fortunate enough to spend the full week in the Supreme Court, either sitting behind counsel or in one of the rooms behind watching it on the video.
Yes.
But, yes, fascinating to be involved in it. And, you know, it's a landmark case.
Absolutely.
That everybody knows about and everybody is now fascinated with,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And really sort of shaped that sort of dualism as between international law and domestic law and the relationship there.
Yes.
So we continue to see it as a guiding principle.
Well, it's really interesting because you complete, for me, those who were involved in that case to an extent, Baroness Hale, now, of course, retired, Lord Panic, and, of course, Gina Miller herself, all of whom have been at different times over the years on this podcast. So it's really interesting. Tell me, though, in that case, it was noticeable that there was an absence of women.
Yes.
In front of the cameras, if I may say so.
Particularly on behalf of the government, I'm
yes,
afraid.
Yes, well,
say.
That's where I was going. Yeah. But contrary to that, in your department, your leadership is actually quite heavily.
Absolutely.
Senior leadership.
Yeah. So it was the council team that was
poor,
I'm afraid,
I think I can say that.
Embarrassingly all white male.
Yes.
On behalf of the government.
Yes.
And some listeners will have heard me say in other fora how I've been committed to improving our instruction practices at GLD in order to ensure we have greater diversity amongst the council teams that are representing the government.
Hear, hear.
And my litigation colleagues are actively working on that so that we don't find ourselves in that position again.
Yes.
You know, famous last words. There'll be another one, won't there?
No, but having said that, it's important, isn't it,
to
have a desire for change,
no.
Not just in gender,
yes.
But of course, other characteristics as well.
Absolutely.
But so that's why I was interested to see your leadership team.
So my three deputies on the legal side are all women. Over 50% of our legal director cadre, so that's partners level,
yes,
are women. Because I think the civil service and GLD attracts great women.
Yeah.
But we've had for many, many years, long before it became fashionable, we've embraced flexible working,
yeah.
We've supported families, we've supported people to juggle their family lives and their professional lives. Mm. We have In fact, the current Attorney General used to be a government lawyer.
Yes, within, I read that. Victoria Prentice.
That's right, yes. within the predecessor of the government legal department and was one of the first job share duos at deputy director level. So we've really been in the vanguard of those flexible working practices, which actually attracts lots of men who want to take family life seriously as well.
Yes, yes.
So it does create a particular culture, I think, one that's supportive, one where it's not, as I would describe it, elbows at dawn.
Yes.
In fact, when colleagues have family responsibilities, what you find is people leaning in and taking on some of their cases or providing a bit of extra support, telling them to go home and collect their ill child from school.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's the sort of culture we want to promote and continue and maintain.
Absolutely. God, you're really selling this. This is sounding very attractive to somebody listening. So let me pose this question. If, for example, two questions really, one in turn. The first one is, if having listened to this podcast, or, you know, doing a bit of research, and one is listening who's about 10 years cool, or 12 years cool, and thinking, I fancy this. I fancy that, you know, this sounds great, an opportunity to be in the heart of sort of lawmaking, really.
Yep.
What career advice might you give to somebody at that level? And then the secondary question is for somebody very junior wanting to enter the law per se. So they're two big questions, I know. But I'm thinking, you know, somebody's been perhaps in private practice, whether at the bar or, you know, our sister's profession, the solicitor's profession, and others, and is thinking, it's time for a change, something a bit more challenge.
Well, I think because our work is unique, we don't really expect people to come with huge amounts of necessarily directly relevant experience.
Yes.
We recognise that it's so different to what most people do in private practice that actually we're looking for aptitude. We're looking for people with an interest in law and politics and the relationship that that entails. We're looking for people who are committed to public service, who recognise that you might not get the financial rewards that you get in the private sector, but actually the impact of the lawyers in GLD on everyday life in the UK is significant. And it's a huge privilege to those of us that get to do that. So, as I say, we tend to look for aptitude and commitment and interest. I would say, in terms of tips, we certainly have lots of examples of people coming from private practice mid-career or perhaps post-family or post-caring responsibilities. And in fact, I was just talking to a colleague at one of our introductory training sessions the other week who came up to me and said, thank you so much for giving me, I mean, that wasn't me personally, but, you know, thank you so much, GLD, for giving me an opportunity to do some amazing work local to me in Leeds that I would never have had the opportunity to do in times gone by. So that is really encouraging for me and, you know, really inspiring, actually.
Yes, it is. And of course, as we know, I am always talking about the breadth of care and responsibilities. Elder care and people returners is really important to remember to keep those in the profession who've got all those skills after a break. And what about a junior person? You know, starting out, maybe not necessarily in Bolton, just thought of another Bolton person, Dame Janet Smith.
Indeed.
Shipman Inquiry, another Bolton lass. I'll be thinking about all of these once we've finished. But I wonder for, you know, younger or aspiring lawyers, you know, this is a different playing field for them now. There are less opportunities when they ought to have been. We've been in a pandemic, very difficult. And they'll be thinking about skills and, you know, in different ways to practice law. So I wondered if you had any tips, particularly sometimes for those from underrepresented groups, which is a term I don't like, but I would say marginalised groups, you know, who don't always feel as though they're perceived as belonging. If you just want to be a lawyer and you're thinking, I want to come into the profession, what skills or tips might you give? I suppose from a government legal department point of view, because a lot of people don't know what you do now.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't know what you do.
So I would recommend people have a curiosity about the relationship between government and the state. So if you're a student, brush off your public and administrative law. There's a publication that we GLD produce, which we produce it primarily for our lay clients, but it's called A Judge Over Your Shoulder.
Oh.
And there's the sixth edition has just been published. You'll find it on the website. It's publicly available.
Great. I'll share a link to it.
Yes, do. And that talks about the relationship between the government and the state. It talks about the legal framework within which government decisions are made. Mm. Talks about the duties that government ministers are under in developing their policy and then sometimes preparing legislation. Sometimes it doesn't need legislation. But all of those public law principles of rationality and correct use of powers, that sort of thing, is explained in that publication in layperson's terms.
Yes.
So if you think you might be interested in government law, have a read of that.
Great. And what might be a lay, you said a lay, for our lay clients, what would be a lay client?
So that's a fellow civil servant,
a
policy developer, who doesn't have a legal background, but many of them, of course, are steeped in the legislative process and the formulation of government policy.
Yes.
But for those very new to the profession or even just exploring other opportunities, we in GLD run a legal trainee scheme and pupil barrister scheme, which is highly competitive and very sort of very much sought after. And we're also exploring the use of the development of an apprenticeship scheme and early talent generally, some of which I think will be of particular interest for those from perhaps less privileged socioeconomic backgrounds.
Yes.
Our recruitment practices are aimed at trying to eliminate preferential treatment for those of particular privilege.
Yes.
So we are university blind, we are name blind.
I was going to say name.
In many of our early stages of our recruitment processes, in order to have a level playing field so that, in accordance with civil service principles generally, our appointments are absolutely on merit and merit alone.
Fantastic. Crikey, I feel like I'm advertising this now. I'll go back to being neutral. Well, it doesn't matter. Might I ask you perhaps a serious question then? Because you're advising government departments, I'd like to ask about impartiality of service.
Mm.
And what does that mean? Can you be impartial? And do you have to be on side of the government of the day, for example? I ask that because of the title and perhaps the work. How does that work? How does sort of impartiality or independence work, you know, in this circumstance?
So it's very similar to general counsel in the private sector,
yes,
who are employed by their employers, their company, and are very much there to help the company achieve its objectives. But of course, still absolutely bound by professional obligations of ensuring you act in your client's best interest.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, as a civil servant and a lawyer,
yes,
we are politically impartial, which means that our advice is not tainted by any of our personal political views.
Yes.
And we are there to deliver for the government of the day. So it's not entirely independent, but it is impartial and non-political.
So, because obviously we all watch the news, you know, even those of us at the bar are watching the news. But if there's a new government in 2 years' time or whatever, presumably your work just carries on with the new government of the day.
It will, because the government of the day will have new priorities.
Yes.
And as they come into power, we'll be discussing their new priorities with them. And it's perfectly possible that they will be repealing some of the legislation that the current administration has brought to pass. That's if there's a change of government.
Yes.
If there's not a change of government, there still might be a change in makeup of government, and priorities might shift according to the time. So
yes.
The continuity of the impartial civil service is, for me, one of the great constitutional safeguards that the new government coming in, or new members of parliament, are supported by people who are expert and not politically aligned.
Yes. Well, it's so interesting because it was important for me to understand that, and for listeners to understand that, because I think sometimes it can be confusing. And it's really an interesting safeguard.
And it's important that we're there to deliver for the government of the day, because
Absolutely.
They're the democratically elected government. It's not just a case of, here's my advice, take it or leave it.
Yes.
We strain to get solutions that meet manifesto commitments.
Yes. Now, I want to ask you some fun questions.
Yeah.
You've got a big job. Additionally, you're a bencher at Lincoln's Inn.
Indeed.
You're managing this huge team. Your three immediate deputies are women. I mean, they might be men for all I care. You've got a large department. What do you do for well-being? Because a little bird tells me you're very much into music. You're quite a talented pianist, is that right?
Well, I wouldn't claim to be talented, I'm an enthusiastic amateur. So, I do play the piano, learnt as a child, and then took up lessons again about 3 or 4 years ago. I've been a bit remiss recently, I must confess.
Well, you have been busy.
But it's a lovely thing to do. And music generally is a big passion of mine. So I do try to get to a concert or the theatre almost weekly.
Yes.
So I've got a summer of prom concerts already in the diary, which I'm very much looking forward to.
Good. Well, I'm glad to see, because this is a big job, you know, not just yours, but in general. And we at the bar need to get better at it. And you yourself have said, you know, you get a phone call about something important, you have to react to it. So, you know, we're trying to push well-being. Now, I want to ask you about books. We have a Women in the Law book club. It's not just for women. It's had all sorts of people on, including a secret barrister. And I wondered if you had a favourite book and or a favourite legal character. And why, that you can share with us.
Okay. So I suspect lots of people talk about To Kill a Mockingbird, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. One of my favourites.
And I suspect that did plant a seed back in the day.
Yes.
But I'm not really a big one for reading legal novels these days. But if I may just give a little plug for a former colleague of mine called Anna Mazzola, who is a novelist. She was one of our GLD trainees back in the day, and she writes great books, some of which have a legal dimension to them. But I would absolutely look out for those.
Wow. Well, in my book club, we invite the author. So we would love to have her and discuss her books. That's really, that's a real good plan.
I didn't tell her I was going to do that.
That's all right. This is a neutral podcast, isn't it? That's fantastic. And what about a legal character? Did you ever have one? I know you said To Kill a Mockingbird, so I presume Atticus Finch.
Finch would have been the obvious one. But as I say, I sort of, law was not something, you know, that was a great sort of long-standing ambition. But having said that, I think when I was a child, lots of my sort of role models and inspiration were sportswomen.
Yes.
Because sport is an area where women are more visible.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
So, you know, Virginia Wade winning Wimbledon in the year of the Silver Jubilee is like a historic event for me.
Yes.
So I suspect that was the sort of thing I was looking at as a child. Of course, I would have to say now, wouldn't I, the character Maxine Peake plays in Silk.
Yes.
Being a Boltonian, she could probably do my accent better than this.
That's because you've left Bolton for so long.
It is, absolutely. Yeah.
No, that is fantastically brilliant. Tell me, if I may, I saw that you contributed to certainly the Lincoln's Inn 100 year celebration.
That's
when
right.
The first one was called the Bar.
Yeah.
And as we record this in Gray's Inn, my own inn, we're celebrating, I wouldn't say copying, we're just a bit behind you. Edith Hessling, our own woman, first woman to be called to the Bar. But I wondered, why were you keen to support that project and, I suppose, advocate for women? Because it's a great, great, it's a film in which they interview a series of women at the bar
yeah.
in different roles. And it's a brilliantly wonderful, diverse... How did you get involved in that? Why did you get involved? Do you think it's important to be advocating and celebrating?
I think it is. I think as I became more senior within the government legal department, and frankly, probably having taken for granted the equality that I experienced myself in the civil service... I recognise that that wasn't necessarily replicated elsewhere.
Yeah.
And also, it's very precious. We shouldn't take it for granted. And therefore, I felt, as a senior woman within the government legal department, it was important for me to be more visible.
Yes.
And I thought it was also important for me to be visible as a government lawyer.
Yeah.
Out and about in the profession.
Yes.
And so I take that very seriously. And the 100 Years Women in Law project provided a perfect hook for me to dip my toe in that world of networking across the profession.
Yes.
So to walk into Lincoln's Inn Old Hall to a room predominantly full of women was actually, easier than it might have been had it been a different makeup, shall we say.
Yes, yes, and I can see that, actually. Well, tell me, we talk a lot about imposter syndrome. You know, I'm a short black woman. People think I'm tall until they meet me or see me in court. But in your career, because you've been hugely successful, did you ever suffer it? And I know it's not a syndrome, it's not an official condition or anything. I often feel that it is when one feels as though everybody in the room thinks you don't belong, and when everybody in the room doesn't look like you or doesn't have the same background as you or whatever it is. So there's a feeling of exclusion, which we then think, we don't belong here. Somebody's going to come and say, get out, because everybody thinks that. And I wondered, in your career, did you ever have any instances like that? Because, you know, you're really hugely clever, brainy woman. I'm not just saying that. You know, I've done a bit of research. And, you know, I know people who know you as a child who say, she was just clever. She did have 5 O-levels and got, you know, 5 marks in all of them. But, you know, joking aside, did you ever experience any of those kind of, I don't belong here? And how did you get over it? Because in my own career, it's been trying to overcompensate, knowing the most in the room, over-preparing, you know.
So I very much, I think I alluded to it earlier, in that I very much felt that when I first came to London, particularly when starting pupillage, that I was surrounded by people from very different backgrounds.
Yeah.
And back in those days, I'm afraid, probably, that's probably why my accent isn't as broad a Bolton accent as it might have been back in the day. And also, I think there was an element of faking it to make it.
Yeah.
As you say, overcompensating, making sure that, you know, you could talk the talk when people were talking about rugby or cricket.
Yeah.
Actually, cricket was a good one because my dad liked cricket. But just to feel like you fitted in.
Yeah.
So when I joined the civil service, it was like a breath of fresh air, and I didn't feel necessarily that I needed to do that. Mm. I was surrounded by people from a range of backgrounds, all of whom were super clever, but not necessarily quite so privileged in their background.
Yes.
But that imposter syndrome, if that's or a sort of sense of you have to pinch yourself and think, is this really me? Mm. I'm here. You know, the big events in the legal year, the opening of the legal year.
At the coronation,
indeed.
I saw your tweet. It was just the invitation, I think. I don't even think you were saying anything.
No, absolutely. It was wonderful. No, I was quite coy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you pinch yourself and just think, crikey, what am I doing here?
Yes.
And if I'm feeling unconfident in terms of, and this is a tip I share with junior colleagues, is if I'm feeling unconfident or perhaps not as resilient as I am most of the time, it's worth just remembering some of those little victories early on. Yeah. So I was knocked back at the self-employed bar.
What?
So I was disappointed not to get tenancy in a couple of chambers. And the reason I ended up in the civil service was because I needed a job. Mm. I needed to earn some money. Mm. And I was applying for pretty much every job in the paper that I was vaguely qualified for. So it wasn't a grand plan to join the civil service. But with those knockbacks, and then you overcome them.
Yes.
And it's worth remembering that however unconfident I am now, I'm in a far better, more privileged position than that 22-year-old who failed to get tenancy.
Yes. And it's being able to build that resilience, I guess.
Yeah.
Wow. That is so amazing. I especially like the way that you talk about your team. And because you won some prestigious awards recently, if I may say so.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, come from a legal department. Wow, and there's quite a few women there and various other diversities. And you kind of, you don't talk about yourself. You're often talking about your team. And I think as a leadership quality, it's really wonderful to see that. Is that a deliberate thing or are you just really proud of the team that you've built and the work you're doing?
Well, I'm proud of the team that I've built, but I'm equally proud of the team that supported me. I'm only here because I've had amazing colleagues throughout my career from whom I've learned such a great deal. I mentioned we have a culture that isn't really elbows at dawn and that people are terribly supportive. So I've had hugely encouraging managers throughout my career who have given me great feedback. Sometimes it's been hard to hear, but actually given me the development opportunities that have enabled me to continue to grow. And I want to do that for others. And that's the sort of organisation I want to lead, where it's all about the work. It's all about helping others to reach their potential. And ultimately, all about doing the right thing for society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, what a great role model you are. Is that model, what type of leader do you think you are? What sort of leadership skills you think you have? Because you bring so many people with you. We just saw a young woman as we were entering Gray's Inn who was very friendly and chatty to you. And I thought, crikey, I could be her mother. And she seemed to know you. And to me, that's what great leadership builds, people who want to talk or, you know, connect and remember you. What type of leader do you think you are? What makes a great leader for you?
Well, I'd like to think I'm a very open and accessible leader. So the young woman you referred to, Sally, is one of our current pupils within GLD.
Yes.
She's spending some time at some chambers in Gray's Inn. She's also a Lincoln's Inn member as well. So I've seen her around and about Lincoln's Inn as well.
Yeah.
So I hope I'm approachable. I hope I'm friendly. I hope I set direction, because I think that coming back to that purpose of why GLD is an important part of the civil service, an important sort of constitutional safeguard for the country, is it's really important. Our strap line, as you probably know, is that we help the government govern well within the rule of law.
Yes.
And what that means is the government needs to get the best possible highest quality legal advice to enable it to make its policy decisions. And I think that's a really important purpose for all of us to be united behind.
Absolutely. And to do that, you need the widest possible pool.
That's right. So I think it's really important to celebrate the great work that all of our teams do. And comes back to your point about it not being terribly well known in the outside world.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful for the opportunity to blow our trumpet, our collective trumpet, on this podcast. So at any given moment, we've got colleagues negotiating trade deals, we've got colleagues litigating immigration cases, we've got colleagues, you know, preparing contracts for the most important procurements that government's got on the go at the moment.
Yeah.
vaccines was a case in point during the during the pandemic, which was we advised on the licensing and the approvals of the vaccines, and then went on to do the purchasing of the really important work, collecting, you know, then quite a lot of the work is professionally rewarding and it has a personal real life impact as well.
Yes, you can see quite the results.
Yeah.
Now, there is one woman left in the Supreme Court. I don't say left, the other's retired. And I'm always saying, talking about this on this podcast, and whoever will listen, I suppose. But, you know, Dame Vivienne Rose, who's a bench ruler this in Gray's Inn, of course, was herself a government legal lawyer.
She was.
And there are a number of senior women in leadership positions, Victoria Prentice, I already mentioned, the Attorney General, who have come your route. So I wondered, really, what's next?
Oh, I think this
might we see you? I know, it's a big question. You'll try and fob me off. But might the Supreme Court or, you know, another... you've led so many important departments. I just wondered what was next for
you. I think this is the pinnacle of my career. And I'm not going anywhere anytime soon.
No, I wasn't suggesting that.
Let me just make that clear.
I meant whether you were going upwards.
Yeah,
there's even more.
There's plenty to be done in GLD. I've got huge ambition. We're just about to start on a new strategy period. As you mentioned, there will be a general election in the next couple of years.
Yes.
Whatever the outcome of that general election, I'd like to be the Continuity Act.
Yes, fantastic. Well, I feel like I should be calling you Dame Susanna.
Oh, goodness, no.
But one of the interesting aspects of your work as we come to a close was the coronation and the laws involved.
Yes.
In the coronation, but the Coronation Act, which I think was 12 something. I haven't got my notes in front of me.
It's the Coronation Oaths Act of 1688.
There we are. I think I wrote about it. You probably did too. Did you think in your lifetime you would be using?
No, it's astonishing, isn't it? I mean, such a niche role to be involved in that, and fascinating and a huge privilege.
Yes.
So, and as well as advice on that act and the terminology of the oath and all of that, there were a whole load of other things that our lawyers were advising on.
Well, I was coming to that, which people wouldn't have thought of, you know. I think a lot of people are probably just watching the marches and the concerts and what have you. But there's a whole load of other laws.
Licensing to make arrangements for the use of the parks. And, you know, stopping the traffic, sort of thing. So
it's quite a role.
Once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for some of our most junior colleagues, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, Susanna, thank you so much for talking law with me in this interview. I feel like we haven't talked about a lot of substantive law, but I don't think that's what people listen to this podcast totally for. It's been wonderful to have you on. You're a real inspiration. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Sally. It's been a delight. And I just hope people think about applying to GLD.
Hear, hear. Well, you heard it here first.
Thanks so much to Susanna McGibbon for telling me all about her career and life in the law in this interview. Let me tell you very quickly about Women in Law UK events coming up. Annual conference taking place on the 17th of November this year will take place at DNA Piper in Manchester. Next year's annual dinner will take place on the 7th of March in Manchester. You can find out more details and tickets by visiting womeninthelawuk.com or visit Eventbrite. If you'd like to support Talking Law podcasts, do get in touch. There are many ways, and you can follow the podcast or indeed myself by following on Twitter at SallyPenny1, on Instagram SJSallyPenny, and on LinkedIn at SallyPennyMBE. You can, of course, always type in to LinkedIn Women in the Law UK and follow our page. There are also plenty of other episodes of Talking Law for you to catch up and listen to, over 80 episodes of 3 seasons, and interviews include former Justice of the UK Supreme Court, Lord Jonathan Sumption, an interview with the Right Honourable David Lammy, MP, Lord David Panic, KC, Rob Rinder, and more. Thank you so much to our production team at Purposeful Podcasts. I'm Sally Penny, MBE. Bye for now.